Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myers, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City.
And I'm Josh Pitok, a colorist also in Los Angeles. And this week we wanted to talk about what influences us, what gets us going as colorists, what keeps us motivated to do good work day in and day out. So I guess I'll start with Jason. Can you remember something that you saw that you said, wow, this has amazing color in it. This is something, this is the direction that I want to go in my life.
Well, how about this? I'll talk about like maybe a really early thing that I saw, which I thought was interesting. And it was the first time I'd ever thought that maybe there was something going on in movie color more than just the way it came out of the camera. Because for a long, long time, I think maybe like other people, you know, I just thought that they shot it like that. You know, I didn't know that there was this big process, you know. And so the first movie that was like that for me was Black Hawk Down. Because it was odd. I remember watching that movie and these guys, when they were going through Mogadishu, you know, these sort of warrior elite dudes were running around, you know, they would go into like a bunker or hole somewhere and they'd be getting ready to run to the next hole. And I'd take a look at a wall right adjacent to them. I'm like, why is that like bright turquoise, you know, or why is this like, where's all this green coming from, you know? And so if you look at Black Hawk Down, the thing that's really crazy, I think, is the fact that they did some stuff that sort of in a lot of cases might not have been allowed a lot before then. And I know that was right around the same time as Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? So everybody was probably doing a lot of experimenting. But just once I saw how they were using these bright, definitely non-war zone colors in Black Hawk Down, and it was totally contributing to the story, that's when I first became really sort of amazed that there was more to it than just, you know, how it was shot. So that was the first thing. And then later on, I learned about color mostly, to be honest, because of the three-way color corrector in Final Cut. And then I saw the difference it made. And also I'd done things in Photoshop, but didn't realize how possible it was on something that wasn't a still image. And then it sort of wound up from there. So that was my sort of initial taste of it.
And Josh, like what inspires you? What's driven your aesthetic or driven your, you know, career?
Well, I mean, it may be really, I don't know, obvious. Of course, we're all influenced by Wizard of Oz because of, you know, the difference, the contrast between black and white and color. I actually last night, just for reference, just watched the latest Wizard of Oz movie, Oz the Great and Powerful. And instead of them just doing black and white, they had 4x3 on, you know, crop on the first part of the film, which was interesting because then it feels so much wider once you just get to Oz. But I mean, Wizard of Oz, I always look to as like, this is a great, I think a lot of that stuff was, if I'm not mistaken, it was controlled by Technicolor. They decided what the, you know, the art direction for it, because I guess to shoot on Technicolor, they had to have somebody there on set deciding like, no, the yellow brick road needs to be this yellow. You know, this, she has to be wearing this color dress in order for it to work with the film. So, but I mean, the most important thing about Wizard of Oz is that all that stuff feeds into the story. Like everything is there color wise for a reason. There's a reason why it's a yellow brick road. There's a reason why it's an emerald city and all that. And, probably later that made more sense to me when I saw another film that influenced me, which was Pleasantville, where it was like color in that movie was a character. It was like, you know, a story point. It was all of these different things. And like it was one of those things like the color was so important to that film that it would not have made sense if you didn't have it in there.
And that was also one of the first movies that, and at the time it was treated like an effects shot, but it was actually a DI. That was one of the first movies that had a full DI because every shot had these color effects that were happening. My influences, I think, in terms of what's inspired me in films, they're much more about the cinematographers, I think, than even like the DI process. So, I think there's a little bit of like an antagonistic relationship between cinematographers and DI, but I think the best modern cinematographers are the guys that see the DI and see the colorist as a partner and see it as an extension of their work. And so the films that I think to me were just made me really think about color were movies like, did you guys ever see Little Buddha? That it was like a Bernardo Bertolucci film with like Keanu Reeves and Bridget Fonda. And it was shot in this way where they actually fed the, it took place in various different locations. So part of it takes place in Tibet, and part of it takes place in India, and part of it takes place in Seattle. And they sort of use the color temperature of the scene and the way, and the colors within the scene, within the shot, as a way to separate the different spaces and also kind of imply something about the different places the characters are in. So one set of characters starts out in Seattle, and it's shot this with this very cool light. It's very blue, and to the point where there's one shot where, and it was in a critical scene where the character's sort of discovering something, and they turn on a tungsten light, a filament light, and you see the warmth from the light, and it's shocking how contrasted it is against the coolness of the daylight that's also in the room. And I didn't realize it until I lived in Seattle for a while, but that's what light is like in Seattle. Like, it really captured it, but it also played against the story, and it told you something about the story. And this was something that was done before a DI in the sense that we know it today was even possible.
Before that, all they had was getting it on set. I mean, I guess people were trained that way in order, if you wanted that look, that was it. You had that one opportunity to get it done.
Not only that, but like the DP was the only guy that could really, and whether or not they really knew, it's up for debate, but they were the guys that could really tell you like this, we're getting this or we're not getting this, or this is how it's going to look. And then the next day you'd find out whether or not they were right. And you wouldn't be able to look at it on set and say, oh, that's too warm, that's too cool, this is too much.
Yeah, there's a lot of trust involved.
Yeah, and I think that also limited the way that people would approach things. I think if you look at the visuals that have come out since the advent of the DI, it's really changed up how far we can take things and what directions we take them in or what looks we try to do, because you don't have to risk not getting it right on the set. You can get it safe on the set and then push it in post and try it out that way in a safer environment.
I guess one of the things that I find really interesting too is that, that's the thing, I think, like speaking to your point about the DP sort of DI relationship, one, is that I think DPs might be a little concerned that the idea that you just want to get it safely on set is taking away their options to influence how it's going to look. And I think the corollary also is the idea that a lot of DPs either are not getting specifically compensated for their time in the color bay. I mean, that's a common thing that I hear, is that they are not necessarily paid also to, say, put 2 or 3 weeks worth of reviews into the DI, or they're unavailable because, you know, frankly, if you're a great DP, you might be busy, when DI happens. So, just there's this one thought that it seems like the thing that will help a lot is sort of what's going on in, how do I say it, on-set dailies, with something not necessarily a CDL, but just a really good method to try to convey what they're hoping for on set, the intention, and then getting that to the color bay, also in a way that the colorist and DI people are going to find it useful. Because a really common thing I hear is that, the DPs are like, we tried to do that, and then we just hear the guys in post threw it out. So that's the thing. I mean, everybody who might have done color on a project that was started by someone else probably finds it frustrating to reverse engineer someone else's work. So it's like, how do you bridge that divide between trying to get the notes from the DP in some useful way, which might include a pre-grade or an on-set grade, but also, be happy with the idea that that's a helpful starting point, not a bunch of muck that you have to sort of cull through in order to start working, So,
I mean, I would make the argument that that's the director's job. The director's job is really to helm that thing all the way through. It's like his job is to envision what the script is going to be. His job is to see everything all the way through. So, I mean, I think that the director is the final word.
I think sometimes people use the excuse, like the colorist wanted to take it there, or the we didn't have the LUT, the onset LUT or whatever, as a way to sort of mask that the director really wasn't all that crazy with what the DP's direction was. You know, he wanted a different direction. Or sometimes people change their mind in the edit, or they get feedback from their clients. Directors give creative directors or directors get feedback from their client that want to push it in a different direction. So these things, it's very much a moving target now. What the image is going to look like is a moving target.
If somebody asks us, like, oh, we want a flat look from this because we've been looking at Log C, we're not really happy about doing that, and we'll probably advise against that. But, you know, if that's the way that the director wants to do it, then you kind of have to respect their wishes.
You guys are talking about directors going and helming the color process. I think you're lucky in a lot of cases if you get a director that's color acute, you know. The thing is that a lot of directors actually spend a lot of their time thinking about either framing or story or, you know, the writing. And definitely, I think there's a number out there that will be really invested in color, but there's a lot of them that look at the DP as the guy who's going to set that sort of thing. And, you know, almost, how do I put it? I would say that if there was something that the DP was going to take the helm of himself, it might very well be, you know, color, with the idea that he's going to be a huge component of how it will even turn out. And so if you have a director that's able to, you know, guide that process, I think that's a little bit more exception than rule. But somebody, you know, has to figure out, you know, where the common ground is and sort of maybe mediate it. And so it's a challenge if you have the DP on one end and the DI or colorist people on the other end. You almost do need an arbitrator of sorts, possibly, unless there's a really great format that can be figured out that allows that stuff to be just made very clear and then presented both like sort of from a concept standpoint and also from a technical standpoint in a way that's useful. So, yeah. For instance, if you get some kind of CDL or, you know, color decision, you know, list, whatever the future format might be, you know, you just have to think that that's actually now, after the fact, still valid. I think a lot of people on set will be setting looks and things like that. And it's just like when you're going and doing a fast color session, sometimes you'll go and you'll make all sorts of radical changes, go to lunch and come back and be like, oh my God, you know, what in the heck were we doing? I think that's a very possible scenario on set, especially with the fact that that's an imperfect color environment. So, you know, just, you know, with the idea that you brought this, you know, thought up one, you know, I think the biggest single thing, now that we've all got incredible, you know, tools to work with, both onset and offset, is now how we kind of coordinate it all, which is, you know, the collaborative thing that's a theme across all of post, you know, so.
Okay, I have a question for you guys. We focus on color. We do it every day, day in, day out, 10, 12 hours a day, whatever it may be. How do you guys stay focused, stay inspired, stay interested in doing this every day?
How do you not? I find it fascinating, but to me, it's like I'm constantly trying to challenge myself. I always view my work with a very critical eye. So to me, it's about not kicking myself in the ass later. Like, I just want to get it perfect. You know, it's a little bit of an OCD thing where, you know, I just don't want to. I hate looking at something, you know, 2 weeks later and going, ah, I should have tried this other thing. You know, I always want to try it. And it's about a pursuit of perfection, and in a situation where perfection is impossible because it's very subjective, but that's what it is to me. And so I don't know if I find it hard to be inspired. Sometimes I maybe find it hard to be motivated, or I get discouraged. I find the moments where I'm discouraged are the kind of breakthrough moments where you go, you know, you step away from something. That's a technique I use a lot, is I'll step away from it. So if I'm really frustrated or I'm getting kind of fed up with something, I'll just go, okay, time for a break. And I step out, or I go work on something else, and I come back to it. And usually in the time that's passed, sometimes it's a few minutes, sometimes it's a day, you know, it clicks into place, and I get it.
I think one of the things that's really nice about color and grading. And this is true for a lot of different disciplines, you know, sort of surrounding us. But, you know, in terms of what I really am excited about with color is I just think that it's something you can do your entire life. And just, you know, I don't want to get sort of sentimental or sappy, but there's this idea that it just keeps going. And I think what I really dig is the idea that for that reason, for me at least, it never gets old. It's, you know, a lot of guys that I talk to will mention every single gig. They're like, dude, I swear to God, I thought I had seen every Red project ever or every Alexa project ever. And I completely learned this, like, really new thing that I had never done before. And then it's multiplied by, let's say, the applications that you decide to use. So you could certainly chase that for a long, long time with, you know, just Resolve or, you know, just with Baselite or whatever you have an opportunity to use. But then one day, let's say you get an opportunity with, you know, either Luster or a Film Master or, you know, maybe even something like a Mystica that can start adding VFX in. And you're like, wow, okay, all of a sudden now I can composite. And I just think the thing that really makes it interesting every day for me is, and this is an important concept in a lot of things that I'm interested in, is I don't feel like there's a limit. I feel like it can go on as far as I can take it forever, you know, and forever is a long time, but let's just say as long as I'll be alive, I'll probably still be able to learn something. And one of the things that is key to that is just that it is subjective. So there was a time in my past when I did very sort of what I'll call technical work. So I did sort of post-production engineering, and that's kind of going away now. But what I'll say is that everything was very definite. You know, if you put in like a really great storage system, or if you built a workstation, everything was very much a one or a zero. You know, no questions asked. Yes, maybe there was working better, working worse, but generally it wasn't subjective. It either ran or it didn't. And so now when you get involved with something like this, like filmmaking and other forms of art, there's this possibility that one year, high contrast, you know, heavily saturated will be really cool. And then all of a sudden, due to some trend or some stylistic thing that happens in filmmaking in general, all of a sudden we're looking at washed out log footage and saying, that's what I want. And so it completely can flip the script on you, you know, in a short period of time. And so with that never ending, that's what, you know, I think keeps it interesting, is that it really isn't static, and it's completely based on, you know, our pulse as a society and what we're interested in, just like fashion or clothing or literature or anything else. So,
yeah,
I think the pursuit is to get ahead of that curve and to be the guy setting the trend, right, as opposed to being the guy that understands or follows the trend.
And that requires some adventurous spirit too. So, you know, whoever can chase it down into the dark areas that aren't lit up yet, you know.
It's basically the cross section of like four different things, you know, good craft, understanding the methodology, and then the psychology of what makes something appealing, and the aesthetic, a critical nature to evaluate something and develop a look that's unique and interesting and is something that can catch on.
Yeah.
What about you, Josh? What keeps you going? I know you're more day to day looking at more shots than most colorists, because you're churning out a lot of material. I'm sure you hit points where you're just like sick of it, or what do you do to kind of bust through that?
Well, there's a really, just in this part of the industry, there's a high burnout factor. So, I mean, the things that get me going are, if I want to be sappy about it, it's talking to you guys about this stuff too. It's like stay involved with actual humans and, get from outside of the machine and get out into the world and, talk about this stuff. And, you know, sometimes I like to, even look at other people's reels and just see like how they've attacked certain problems, what looks they have and what they're doing. I like to look at just straight photos. Sometimes I'll just jump on to, if I'm doing like landscape stuff or something that may be like a portrait, I like to just look at portrait on 500px or look at landscapes on Flickr or something like that, and just see pages and pages of just image is great. I love that.
There's a lot of inspiration to be, I mean, photography has so much more control in some ways. And so the kinds of things that you can get out of a still photograph that you can't, that you can kind of strive to accomplish in a color session are really, really compelling. There's a lot of gold in those mines, you know, to kind of dig through. And that's a great source of like reference. And I, you know, one of the things that sometimes I'll do commercial sessions and creative directors will come in, they'll be like, there's this photographer, he does this kind of thing, here's some examples, this is what we're going for. And to me, that's just like, that's a great day right there, because I have a client that has a functioning idea of what they want, cares about the outcome, but not only that, but has brought me a challenge. You know, it's like a little, it's a puzzle. I get to figure out how do I create this look? How do I give them what they want? And there's a little bit of psychology too, because it's not just, sometimes it's not just a straight up transform of that look. Sometimes it's actually something about that look that they really want. And it's not necessarily the color palette or the way, the depth of field, but it's the way that, you know, the skins look, or the way the light is shining, or, you know, there's aspects to it that they're trying to achieve, and that, and catching that and building on it is a real treat.
Yes. Do we need to open up the Technicolor debate?
The Technicolor debate?
What's that? Yeah. Versus like the straight, here's exactly the math behind it, versus like, here's a reference image of it. Now make something that looks similar to this.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's certain like photochemical processes that, and I think this is what's valuable about having an insight on the mechanics of the way images are processed, and also the color science behind it. Because there's a method to a lot of those processes, like Technicolor two-strip or three-strip, bleach bypass, that you can recreate or emulate in color now, that we can do digitally. And I personally think the better approach is, if you just want to get one shot out and you're just trying to bang out a shot, you know, do it however you want to do it. You know, we had that thread on LiftCam again about, somebody was asking about how to do an infrared look, right? You can't really simulate an infrared look, because you don't have infrared light as a piece of information in your session generally. So any infrared look is going to be an inferred look. You're kind of simulating the look as opposed to actually capturing infrared light. So that's open to interpretation. You know, you there's no way to get that technically right. You're just getting it subjectively right. But something like a Technicolor two-strip or Technicolor three-strip, or a lot of other photochemical processes, there is an actual methodology that results in that image. And so you can do something that, you can recreate the process and do something that will work from shot to shot to shot, as opposed to something that only works for that one shot.
And I mean, it depends on the shot too. It's like, some shots will work for that and other shots will just not, it just does not work for that look.
Like, you brought up that whole, the Technicolor consultant being on set for The Wizard of Oz, right? If you don't have the right colors coming in, the Technicolor look isn't going to look right going out, you know, because it's not just about the process, is also about the set design that went into those films.
Right. I mean, actually, I had another thing that really inspired me once, was the, somehow, I don't know how I came across it. I was talking to somebody maybe, but he was telling me about that Velvia film stock. That's like ultra, ultra saturated look, like very rich. And just looked it up and found, oh, well, here's a way to do that in Photoshop. And it was like, oh, well, that's easy enough to interpret back over to Resolve or Symfony or anything else. So it's cool to see that there's some looks and problems that people have already kind of tried to dissect.
Oh, sure.
And I think that there's a ton that people have been doing for years in Photoshop. And I think that we've only hit the tip of the iceberg of a lot of the years that they've put in on that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's good tips and there's not so good tips. I'm sure there's bad versions of Technicolor two-strip that are being done in Photoshop that aren't really the best way to do it. You know what I mean? Like, there's good advice and there's bad advice everywhere. I think there's a wealth of advice in the photo and imaging editing world, because they've been doing this stuff, you know, a good decade longer than we have, and on the desktop side. And so they've just had more time, and there's a lot more people doing it, right? There's, you know, easily 100 times or 1,000 times more people doing photo image editing than there are doing grading on film and video. You know, there's no contest between those two.
Right.
So there's more people doing it. It's more work being done. It's been done longer. So there's a lot more books about Photoshop and photo editing techniques than there are about color correction. There's like 2 or 3 books about color correction. There's, you know, hundreds of books about how to, you know, there's books for, you know, just on hair in Photoshop and, you know, blending modes in Photoshop. That's one, Josh, you recommended, actually. You said it had some interesting techniques.
Oh, yeah.
There's, you know, there's books about the minutiae of photo editing that don't exist about color correction. There's no book on how to get great skins in color in grading. You know, nobody does that.
Yeah. And it's actually, in some ways, it's very different because once you have a shot in motion or two shots that are juxtaposed to each other, it's a completely different feeling too. There's no motion in any of the still stuff. There's no shots that need to be matched across the sequence or, so it's the same, but it's different in other ways too.
Sure. It's a lot easier to do something in a one-off still than it is to repeat it 24 times a second for 10 or 15 seconds or whatever your shot is, right?
Right.
So it's an order of magnitude more complex. But that's still really a wealth of information and technique and ideas and concepts. The still side is something, you know, I love looking at stills, and I'm always referencing stills, and I love looking at what photographers are doing or have done. You know, I'm still, you know, I was looking at some Ansel Adams photographs the other day and just blown away by the images and the way he's using sharpness and detail and contrast, you know, these insane, you know, contrasts on landscapes that are just stunning. And
yeah,
it's something that, you know, I'd love to be able to deliver something like that, you know, one day on a landscape shot. You know, you don't get that many landscape shots, but it's great. It's a great reference point and a great bit of a source of inspiration.
One thing that I really like to go to too is strobist. Just looking at how people light things as well is really cool, and how there's something about the way strobist and all of that work is that they're trying to really, sometimes they're trying to do something with just one light and use the other natural light to fill in or do other, you know, bending of light and all that stuff. But I really dig what they're doing, because they'll break it down. They'll say, here's where the light was. And so you go, oh, and you start really to deconstruct what they're trying to do.
I think even, like, you know, there's that site, Movies in Color, that Tumblr site, you know, that we were looking at the other day, where they're taking stills from movies and just sort of looking at the palette and looking at the process. And it's a great way to kind of, because there's an archive now of like hundreds of these stills, you can look at a progression of the same cinematographer over time. You can look at how he's developed his look. You can look at some really inspiring images from like more recent stuff. So I think there's a lot to get out of looking at older films before DIs, because I think there's great technique and great attention to detail in those films that we can learn from and benefit from today. Now that we have this fine control, I think sometimes we don't see the big picture the way they did, or the other way, we don't see the detail the way they did. And I think that's one of those things where there's a lot of value in looking at what people were doing before DIs, and how can we, you know, strive to always reach that level of excellence, and how can we build on that level of excellence? You know, I think there's people would make the argument that, like, you know, the more recent Steven Soderbergh films have visually, you can look at the progression of his films from when he was shooting on film through to the Red camera and all the stuff he's done with Red, and even some stuff he did with like Sony F900s and all this other stuff. And you can see a progression of he's definitely getting more stylized looks, and there's much more of an influence on the look, especially because he's shooting his own stuff.
I look at a lot of Steven Soderbergh's films. I really dig that style, because one of the things that I find really interesting is to try to figure out, you know, I guess you could say, like, what's allowed. You know, sure. So there's this thought when you're starting out in color that you want to how do I put it? You're excited about initially having the control over color, let's say, but then there's this idea you don't want to sort of mess up, you know, so you're trying to be very, you know, careful about things so that you don't make it look worse. That's probably a good initial goal as an early colorist, let's say. But then there's situations where you'll see, like, I think a really good example is Traffic. So I really like Traffic a lot. And yeah. Traffic was shot on film, wasn't it? That was like 1999 or 2000, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they had that heavy kind of color cast, right. You know, between cities. Yeah.
So it's hyper stylized. And you know what else I'll say is that, you know, if I could say this and not be insulting about it, because I really love it, is that it's almost like it's a very splotchy kind of color. Like if you take a look at, say, a character in Washington, D.C. in that, I think Washington's sort of like a very blue-green almost. Mm-hmm. You can see where, like, the color keys stop at, like a politician's beard, you know what I mean? Where they've been trying to, like, key skin tones, or they're, you know, keying some sort of, you know, part of the HSL color. And essentially there's this situation where you're like, I definitely can see where they were trying to grab skin tones here. And it's not as exact as you would think would be required for that level of filmmaking. But then there's this weird angle where you're like, okay, so that's obviously got to be distracting, but it really adds to it, you know, in this sort of, I don't want to say caricatured way, but it makes Washington feel like Washington. And when you go to Mexico, it's this crazy yellow, and it makes Mexico feel like Mexico, you know? And so you really know exactly where you are in this very distinct way. And it's very sort of overboard by a lot of counts, but at the same time, it just makes Traffic kick butt as a movie, you know? And then you've got these other situations where people are incredibly meticulous and everything is very, very precise. And, you know, that's a great way to go too. And so then you go and you say, okay, so how come Steven Soderbergh was able to do this sort of what we'll call splotchy color grade and completely get away with it? And so then you just start wondering, like you said, Juan, about those four elements that, you know, kind of that you balance while you're doing grading. It's just which one of them kicks in when, you know? And I think that's the thing that's really enigmatic that I really find super fascinating is if I go berserk on this, what is determining whether I'm right or wrong about it? You know, and I say berserk with the idea of just, if I got really wild with something, you know, what would be the thing that would come into play to make me right or wrong and to make me great or awful? And so Steven Soderbergh seems to have figured out this odd situation where he can do almost anything he wants. Like Magic Mike is incredibly yellow, and it's weird. You just go with it and you're like, yeah, we're in Miami, you know, this is what Miami feels like, you know? And so that's the crazy thing for me.
I mean,
you know?
Here, what I would say is if you take it like Magic Mike and then you compare it to, say, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It feels like it fits in that. And it feels like stuff like Magic Mike is just going overboard to go overboard, in my opinion. I mean, I like it. I respect the look. I respect what he's trying to do with it. But I feel like there's more subtlety in other things. I don't think you have to be hit over the head with it so damn hard.
There's also a difference in the way you're perceiving it when you're perceiving it in a theater with a zero light environment. You have no point of reference versus how you're perceiving it in your home, you know, television screen where you have ambient light and you have white wall and you have a point of reference. So that perception also changes how far you can push things. I think in a theatrical environment, you can push color temperature a lot more than you can in a home video environment.
Right. I mean, that's why they actually have like trim passes for all of those movies too.
I really liked Magic Mike as a movie. I thought it was really interesting. And then I was very, you know, the yellow popped really hard. But then when my eyes got used to it, it became just the environment of that movie. You know what's interesting? A movie I didn't get used to was Hugo. So Hugo's, you know, had this really, really heavy push, you know, kind of like the orange and turquoise. I mean, it was really quite there were moments when it was sort of when it shifted away from that. But there are scenes, especially when I don't know how to put it, when they're discovering the robot or whatever, the mechanical man. All of the blacks and a lot of the like midtones and stuff are just really blue, and then as you get higher into the highlights, it becomes just this really blazing yellow. And I was really excited about Hugo because a lot of people had said it was amazing. And when I got in on the movie, I found that was really distracting for me. But then you go and you've got a movie that's sort of, let's say, similar, like Prometheus, which had a really, really intense dichotomy like that as well, with sort of the green and the yellow, especially in the helmets. And I thought that worked really well. And so that's the thing that's odd about it, is just like, Josh, you were saying Magic Mike bothered you. And so it almost just, you know, as you get, you know, sort of more and more radical with it, it seems like you're going to start digging into people's, you know, taste palette, I guess, harder and harder. And that's the risk, is the idea that, you know, as you go for it more and more, you're going to really offend some people and you're going to really thrill some people. And I guess, what's that old saying? Like, you know, you're a rock star when half the world loves you and half the world hates you. So, you know, that's what it takes to be a rock star, I guess.
Part of my problem with Magic Mike too, is that it's kind of how I watch movies these days, is that I watch more trailers than I watch actual movies.
Sure.
And so, I mean, you can really bang through so many different styles, so many different looks. If you just flip on your Apple TV, just watch just every trailer back to back. And you really, I mean, I love doing that. I sometimes watch watching trailers more than I like watching movies, to be honest.
One question I had for you, Josh, real quick was, you're doing these reality shows, and the one thing I was always wondering about is, now that reality is becoming a high art and it's a very sort of figured out workflow, are you finding that you can be more stylized, or that your producers are looking for more than just a balance? I mean, are they going for it in any way in reality? Is that trickling into the reality world now that it's like sort of a very refined process?
Well, I find that we have a lot of liberties we can take with B-roll. That's one really ripe spot where they're just like, do whatever you want. Same with the editors. I mean, the editors go crazy with certain B-roll transitions and stuff like that. So that's an area that is kind of up for whatever you want to do. But I take a lot of cues from the DPs too. And lately I've been getting a lot more DPs that want to come in and take a look at their stuff too. And I'm going to be starting another season of that Ghost Mind show too. So they're very involved with how they want everything to look and what was working, what wasn't working. You know, how
have you planned out how are you going to grade the ghosts when they show up?
Yes, very carefully.
Ghost needs lots of midtones.
That's right.
Lots of highlights
skin,
too, I guess.
Skin work on ghosts is a bitch, let me tell you.
They're so picky. They're like, they always want to come in, check stuff out, you know. Crash
they're so tough to qualify too.
It's part of the reason why I do it. Maybe it's just the company that I'm working for, or the, you know, there's so much that you can do with this stuff. There's so little time, but you can take a lot of liberties with it as long as the people trust you to do what you like. It's just with the amount of time that you have, what you can do with it too. So I think that anything that you're doing to it to improve it makes is a big help. So,
guys, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, but to close out the show, like, if you had to pick someone who's never seen a movie, they've grown up in the rainforest, they've never seen a movie before, and you want to show them one film to show them how beautiful film can be, what film do you show them?
Desert Island Color Picks.
as a colorist, there's what is the most striking? It could be graded, it could be shot. Just strikingly beautiful film.
I know what I always keep as my baseline for a movie, and it's Blade Runner is always my choice that I go to, just for the I don't know. There's just something about that movie that I just love. Jason.
Wow. Jason.
Gosh, I feel like I'm at the restaurant and I don't know what to order yet. and I want you guys to pick yours. Gosh.
Or it's like, what's your favorite movie for the car? For, you know, in the club, in the...
Yeah. Well, how about this? I think, like, you know, I feel like I'm betraying my people a little bit here, but it's also just a nod to what we have to live up to. But the minute you asked that question, Juan, the first thing that popped in my head is just scenes from Inception. I thought at one point that actually had a DI process, but I actually don't think it did. I think that was completely color timed all the way through. I'm not sure. There is a DI artist or a colorist in the IMDb notes for Inception, but you know, I don't know if you guys have seen on the web, there's a lot of popular shots of Inception, but there's this one shot of Leonardo DiCaprio sitting in sort of a lounge, like living room scene, and he's got it's like a 9mm or a Sig Sauer or something, and it's up by his head and he's kind of contemplating things. And when I just think of what I would love to grade one day, at least one movie, you know, I think of that. If I could have one of those on my wall, that would be really, really cool. So probably Inception, just for not only the fact that it's wonderfully shot, but also the set direction and just the art direction and the way that they plan everything out and the way it came together. And just even the VFX. I mean, you take a look at the actual photography and then the VFX themselves. They just come together in a way that's just, I think it's really hard to nitpick that movie in any way. So that would probably be my pick.
There's a trilogy of films, the three color trilogy, you know, the red, white, blue. Krzysztof Kieślowski, like he's a, I think he's Polish, but it's a French, series. And there's one of them is a film called Red, which I just think was one of the first films I saw where I was made aware. And you're made aware because it's in the freaking title, but it's named after a color. But I was made aware, like truly aware of the significance and effect of color and the meaning of it and the impact that it, emotional impact that it can have. And so I think that movie to me is a point of reference of how important color can be and what it can do and what it represents. And the whole trilogy is wonderful, but that one in particular, blue is also amazing and so is white, but I think that one in particular would be my pick. Like, this is what color is about.
Did they have a DI? Was there a DI at all on those? Or
no, that was from that movie? That must have been from like 96 or something like that.
All film as well. 94. And so we have all. Is it just me or have we all just picked films that had no DI? Wow.
Beautiful films. There's beautiful films that have had DIs. You know, it's not like, but I think, you know, we're in a phase right now where everything is possible, and so I think people are kind of experimenting and trying to figure it out. I thought one of the most beautiful DI'd films that I've seen was The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Did you guys see that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought it was just stunningly, stunningly shot. And I'm sure there was heavy DI work in that film. And it was just gorgeous. It was a gorgeous looking film. One of the most beautiful I've seen in a long time. I think... And Jason, we were talking about this the other day, that movie Hard Candy. I think that's a beautiful piece of color work. And in fact, the colorist is credited in the opening credits.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he just had a very significant impact on the story. I think the color timing feeds heavily into what's going on in the story itself. I think that's an example. If you're looking at what the importance of color timing can be or how it can play into a character, into a situation, into a plot, into the audience expectation, that's a great point of reference. And a film, every colorist should watch that movie.
Okay, you guys are going to make fun of me for this one, okay? I'm secure enough to say this, but I don't know if you've ever seen it. The Devil Wears Prada.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It actually is a very good looking film. And a lot of the stuff is, the color is really well motivated. There are certain scenes in there where you know what they're going to pick out. Like, they're going to talk about this dress, or they're going to talk about this outfit, or they're going to pick this part of it out. And I was like, oh my God, I totally took the cue from the way they did the color.
That's a great point.
Yeah. And it's really interesting too, because they talk about color from like a fashion perspective too. There's this one moment when Meryl Streep's character is, I think, looking at a bunch of different colors of blue or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I it's a while since I saw it, but there's this scene. They're in this little, like, sort of like a fabric choosing room or whatever. And like, we're a manufacturer or whatever it would be. And this girl's like, oh, they all look the same to me. And Meryl Streep just gives this like lecture on that right there is a vermilion blue that became popular in 1996 and blah, 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 blah. And she goes off and she's like, pretty soon that'll be in a Walmart. But right now it's being chosen by me right now. You know, and she like lays down the law.
Well, I mean, it's really refreshing for us now to do another complete art show, to get away from the tech a little bit and talk about what is inspiring us. And, you know, it's really interesting to hear all your takes also on all of the movies and ideas and photographers and all of that as well, it's actually inspiring me to take a look at some of these other things as well. And I'm sure on Lift Gamma Gain, all of you guys have certain films and movies and photographers. And I'm inviting all of you guys to come out there and post and you know, show us pictures and all of that to keep all of these creative juices flowing. Also, I should mention that we have a new Twitter account, at Coloristos on Twitter. So feel free to tweet to us, mention us, and we will send all of our new show posts up to you through that Twitter account. If you want to talk to me directly, I'm on Lift Gamma Gain and my website, joshptalk.com, or on Twitter as at joshptalk.
And I'm Jason Myris. You can catch me on Lift Gamma Gain as well, or at Jason Myris on Twitter, and also at jasonmyris.com on the web.
And I'm Juan Salvo. You can catch me at j_Salvo. I'm a Lift Gamma Gain. I'm all over the web. Thank you for joining us. And we hope we've inspired you in some way, and we'll catch you next time.